Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at shifting political winds in Silicon Valley. This week, Donald Trump's chat with Elon Musk cemented their friendship after years of animosity. But he's not the only tech entrepreneur shifting his support behind the Republicans. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. We'll hear analysis on the news that Sudan's army is saying it will join the peace talks in Geneva. And we'll look at the media landscape in Senegal following a news blackout earlier in the week. What's going on there? It's Friday, the 16th of August. First, we go to Nigeria. I'll start this episode with a question. What connects three jets in the French capital, Paris, and two houses in the British city of Liverpool? Well, they are all assets belonging to the Nigerian government that a Chinese company is trying to seize over unpaid debt. It all goes back to a deal that the Ogun State Regional Government made with a company called Zhongshan Fucheng Industrial Investment almost 20 years ago. The company was supposed to build a free trade zone, but the deal fell apart. And now the federal government has been dropped into the aftermath. Our business reporter Nkechi Obona has been telling me all about it.
Zhongshan, I would call them just Zhongshan because the name is quite long. So Zhongshan is a Chinese firm that entered into an agreement with Ogun State. Ogun State is a subnational government in southwestern Nigeria. And the agreement was to build and manage a free trade zone in Ogun State. Now, Ogun State is neighboring Lagos State, which is Nigeria's commercial center. And because of the bustling economic activities in Lagos, Ogun State sought to benefit from that by having a free trade zone. Lagos already has an existing free trade zone. And so Ogun State just wanted to replicate that same gesture and tap into the bustling economic activities in Lagos. And so an agreement was reached with this Zhongshan company to build and manage the facility. But in 2016, the deal fell through the cracks. And in 2021, the Chinese firm sought legal action against the Ogun State government for a breach of contract. And they were awarded about $74.5 million in damages.
Right. So for those who might not know, what exactly is a free trade zone that they were trying to build?
So a free trade zone is an area in a country that is a special economic zone. What that means is goods may be imported or manufactured or stored or re-exported from that area void of customs regulation. So what that means is certain duties, certain tariffs that would have normally been imposed if those goods were manufactured in a customs zone in that country would not be reflected. So you may have free export tariffs or free import tariffs. It's a way that most countries or subnational governments use to attract investments and to boost trade and economic activities in their country. So they build free trade zones, encourage national, international companies or local companies to use those free trade zone areas to boost trade in order to increase those countries' foreign exchange earnings.
And now Zhongshan wants, or it is reported that it wants to seize some assets, and it has got some court orders for that. What sort of assets are they going after?
So the company has spent the last couple of years actually looking out for Nigerian assets simply because the $74.5 million it was awarded at the end of the breach of contract arbitration that had been going on. The Ogun State government has obviously failed to pay the debt that it was awarded. And so the company decided to go after Nigeria's assets. So First off, a Paris court has ordered the seizure of three presidential jets that belong to Nigeria. Now, these three jets were in France for servicing, two of which are up for sale, and one is a newly acquired presidential jet that will be added to the presidential fleet. And so these three have been grounded in France by a court order. Also, in the UK, two houses belonging to the federal government have been seized in Liverpool. A UK court has also granted that. So the documents show that the company has actually begun to look for Nigeria's assets in countries like Belgium, in Canada, Singapore, in the US as well, and the British Virgin Islands. So they are actually going for Nigerian assets that are located in these global places.
Yeah. And do we know what sort of legal framework would allow a private company like Zhongshan to be able to seize government assets?
Now, that's the very big question that a lot of people are asking. But what we do know is, under international law, once there is a breach of contract between a subnational government or a regional government, the national or federal government is also liable and is responsible for the actions of that subnational government. In this case, Nigeria is also a defendant in this arbitration against Ogun State. Moreover, this deal was signed after Nigeria and China signed a bilateral investment treaty back in 2001. However, this free trade zone deal was between the Ogun State government and the Chinese firm under that treaty. So the argument then is, because that agreement covers all investments made between Nigeria and China, therefore they would have access to the national assets. But Nigerian authorities are arguing that these are national assets and they are covered by the sovereign immunity of Nigeria, and they are solely used for diplomatic purposes, so should not be seized by any entity, be it a corporate entity or another national government.
And finally then, what are Nigerians saying about this?
Well, Nigerians have been very aware. Conversations have been happening since the news broke. Opposition candidates, you know, have been calling this a national embarrassment to Nigeria on the way the case is being handled, first off, and then the seizure of these assets. And it also brings to question again, because among these assets is a newly acquired presidential jet that will be added to the presidential fleet. Now, Charles, you must know that Nigeria has a total of 10 planes in Nigeria's presidential fleet. So there are 4 helicopters and 6 aeroplanes, some of which are out of service, and the government has said it was going to sell off those assets. But a new one was acquired, and opposition parties and, you know, Nigerians alike are saying the government is very tone deaf to the plight of Nigerians. I mean, earlier this month, we had a 10-day protest against the cost of living, against bad governance in the country, and reckless spending by the government. And so it was expected that, you know, the government will curtail its spending on some of these assets that it has been acquiring in recent times. And so these seizure of these assets and the threat by the Chinese firm to go even for more assets that are located in several other parts of the world shows that they mean business, and Nigerians are very embarrassed by the outcome, despite the Ogun State government and the Nigerian government saying they are approaching it diplomatically and legally as well. The government has said it's going to seek orders to overturn the seizure of the assets and the return of these assets back to Nigeria. But until that happens, it's very topical in the country, and a lot of people are seeing it as an embarrassment from a series of embarrassments. We've had a very poor outing at the Olympics, where there were lots of issues administratively with our athletes, and now we've metamorphosed into the seizure of our national assets in foreign countries. And so everybody is asking, when would this actually stop?
Yeah. Couldn't have happened at a worse time, this news of the possible taking away of these assets by a private company. Thank you, Nkechi.
Thank you, Charles. Lovely speaking to you as always.
Nkechi Obonna in Nigeria. Now, we've been speaking about Sudan quite a bit in the podcast this week, and we don't usually bring you day-to-day updates on a story. But today's development could be significant. That's if all goes according to what we are hearing. That development in a moment, but if you're following this hugely important story step by step, you remember that peace talks began 3 days ago on Wednesday in Geneva. But neither the army nor the RSF were there on day one. However, a delegation from the RSF is believed to have travelled to Geneva. Also, Sudan's army chief and de facto leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, had previously said he would boycott these talks. However, Sudan's state-owned news agency has now said General al-Burhan has agreed to join talks as long as they were being mediated by the same facilitators of last year's stalled Jeddah peace process. If the army joins the discussions, it is a major step forward for the US-led effort to try and secure a ceasefire in Sudan. Before we go to today's analysis of what significance this potentially holds, let's listen back to the witness voice we heard from earlier this week. Leila Molana Allen is a special correspondent with America's Public Broadcasting Service. She's traveled across Sudan, and this is some of what she shared with us on Wednesday.
The first thing that we heard from everyone in these desperate situations they're in, from all parents, is my kids haven't been in school for 18 months. That really is so many people's first concern because, of course, they're facing daily violence and hunger, but they're also terrified about the future because of how much this war has destabilized the country. Sudanese are obviously extremely proud of the great education system they have. In terms of food, people were saying, even people who still have access to certain kinds of food, people were saying to me, you know, the price of meat has gone up 5 times in the last month. There's just no way I can afford it. All we're eating is lentils. They're eating sorghum bread that's being made by locals because wheat is too expensive. So hunger is a huge issue as well. And the other thing that we heard repeatedly from everyone, people who've been displaced at this point 4, 5, 6 times, is that every time they move to a new displacement area, they're told it's safe. And then suddenly the RSF comes and the speed with which they come, they have minutes to get out. So they drop everything. They can't take anything with them. They can't find their family members. So people are getting separated. People don't know whether their family members are alive or not, and just moving again down the road, often on foot, trying to find somewhere else.
Leila Molana Allen on the state of Sudan. I caught up with my colleague Kalkidan Yibeltal on today's development. Let's listen.
Since the announcement of these talks in Geneva, there had been a sort of reluctance from the army, and even days before the beginning of the talks, the US government was trying to persuade representatives of the army to attend the talks. But they have had their own reservations. One of them is they had these preconditions that their rival, the Rapid Support Forces, must withdraw from the urban centers that it controls. They said that the RSF had agreed to withdraw from these urban centers and cities that it controlled in another declaration that was held in Jeddah, in the Saudi city of Jeddah. So they wanted that to be respected. That's one of the things that they raised. Another thing that they say is they oppose to the idea of the United Arab Emirates being invited as an observer. Now, these talks are facilitated by the US government, but there are other stakeholders participating. One of them is the Swiss government, which is hosting these events, but others like the Egyptian government are invited, and also the Emirati government is invited as an observer. The army had been accusing the United Arab Emirates of providing support for the Rapid Support Forces, and because of that, it's opposing its involvement as an observer. The United Arab Emirates, of course, denies these allegations that it backs the RSF.
And what has been the attitude of the RSF to these US-led talks?
Well, the RSF welcomed the talks, and they traveled to Geneva earlier in the week, and then they said that they would welcome the move and they're happy to comply with these efforts. It seems that they're using these talks and then these international stages to build their profile and their status as well, because in 16 months of war in Sudan, there had been accusations of several rights violations, including possible war crimes against the army and the RSF. The RSF has particularly been accused of other gross violations, including ethnic cleansing in the Western Darfur areas that it controls. Rights groups have blamed it and accused it of targeting non-Arab ethnic groups in those areas and committing crimes against them in what they say could amount to even genocide. So it seems that the RSF is now trying to shake up that image and then build its international status by eagerly accepting these talks, and then it sent four of its delegations to Geneva earlier in the week.
And how significant is it, Kalkidan, that now we have two of the warring parties willing to sit on the same table and talk about a possible ceasefire or even an end to the fighting in Sudan?
Well, I think we have to be cautious, and it's really difficult to be optimistic about diplomatic efforts with regard to the Sudan war, because this is not the first time that both parties were invited to different negotiations, talks. There had been several attempts by the Saudi government, by the African Union, by the regional bloc of East African countries called IGAD, and by other neighboring countries like South Sudan and Egypt. But none of these diplomatic efforts in the past year and nearly a year and a half have not succeeded. So it's difficult to be optimistic. And when it comes to these talks now, why the RSF said that they would welcome and accept the talks and they send their delegations quickly, still we're seeing some reservations from the army side. They're still laying out preconditions. They said that they do not object to the idea of the talks per se, but they still have their own preconditions. So unless we see both parties attending in the talks, and then unless there is some sort of consensus and agreement reached, which in turn implemented into practice, it's really difficult to be eagerly optimistic about peace efforts.
Let's talk about the U.S. because they are leading this process. Antony Blinken, who's the U.S. Secretary of State, is on record saying that the army has a responsibility to join these talks. Does it in any way reflect Washington's muscle in regards to its influence or the United States' influence in Sudan? Or is it too early to judge at this point?
Well, the United States and other Western nations have been accused by rights groups of not giving much attention to the crisis in Sudan. It's one of the world's grave humanitarian crises. And there have been particularly accusations that the U.S. was not using its status, its position to influence and to put pressure on the warring factions and other external actors that might have leverage and weight on the warring factions. So now, after appointing a special envoy for Sudan, the special envoy Tom Perriello has been traveling to the Horn of African countries, to other Gulf nations, and try to increase pressure on these warring factions. But we will have to wait and see how much that pressure is going to be successful in terms of bringing these two powerful generals and their armies to the table and then forcing them to agree at least on a ceasefire and on an unrestricted access to humanitarian aid, and then to try to resolve the crisis. So we'll have to wait and see how much the U.S. and then its allies and partners are going to be successful in applying their pressures and their weights on these factions.
Just remind us why this ceasefire is so important.
Well, as I mentioned, Sudan currently is facing one of the worst humanitarian crises. Millions of people are currently homeless. Many of them have crossed borders and are seeking refuge in neighboring countries. Others are internally displaced. In addition to that, aid is very much restricted because of the ongoing conflict that has led to the worsening of this crisis. In some parts of Sudan, particularly in the West Darfur areas, in some areas, famine has already been declared, which is emblematic of the seriousness and the severity of the situation. And even a few days ago, there was a statement coming from the UN saying that we are reaching a turning point right now in Sudan, and that statement is echoing what has been said by different rights groups, international organizations like the UN and charities like the Red Cross, that there is a very dire humanitarian situation in Sudan. There is even the possibility of the country collapsing, and that is a direct result of the ongoing conflict. These diplomatic efforts are very much significant. They are of paramount importance because they have to silence the guns first, and they have to help the roads to be opened for humanitarian aid to be provided for the millions of desperate people there.
Okay. Thank you, Kalkidan.
Thank you for having me.
The BBC's Kalkidan Yibeltal. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at shifting political winds in Silicon Valley. This week, Donald Trump's chat with Elon Musk cemented their friendship after years of animosity. But he's not the only tech entrepreneur shifting his support behind the Republicans. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Senegalese commuters hoping to browse the news on their way to work on Tuesday were left disappointed because most national newspapers were in protest, refusing to publish. They were protesting against what they say is shrinking media freedom under the new government. The local council of press distributors and publishers said the media is experiencing one of the darkest days of its history and accused the government, led by former opposition politicians, of freezing the bank accounts of media companies and seizing the equipment over alleged non-payment of taxes. Now officials justify the crackdown. They said they were trying to end practices that lead to financial embezzlement and mismanagement in the media industry. My colleague Audrey Brown has been speaking to Hamadou Tidiane Sy, an independent journalist in Dakar. So what happened?
Well, what happened is, of course, everybody knows that the situation that the media worldwide is undergoing, and I think the Senegalese media is no exception. The previous government was finding ways, or had to find ways, to support this media. The former president, just before he left, tried to make some fiscal facilities to the media based on negotiations they had with the Association of Media Owners and Publishers, what would be the equivalent of a media guild in other countries. Now, the new government is saying those fiscal facilities are not to be accepted, and the media owners and media publishers have to pay their dues, and started taking tough measures against the media who were not paying. And also the new government, because they believe some of the media was supporting the former government, cut off some contracts that these media had with government organizations, government bodies. So what happened at the end is a lot of media houses, it was becoming extremely difficult to run their daily operations. And at the end of the day, that they called for this boycott through the Media Owners and Publishers Association.
Is it just a fiscal issue, or is it also what many others are saying, and that is that governments have in various ways down the line up to this one been trying to shut down the press, to curtail press freedom?
Oh, no, of course. I mean, I'm just telling you the facts from the government side. That's an issue, that fiscal, that tax issue is what they're putting forward. But definitely the idea is for this government, any media that is not supportive or considered not supportive of the actions of the new government is an enemy. Because remember, we've gone through 2 years of difficult and very tough political tensions, violence. And the new government believes that many of the media houses did not support them, and now they have to pay for it, meaning you have to respect all your dues with the fiscal, with the fiscal authorities, or you will be shut down. There will be no facility. There will be no exemption. There will be no excuse. But definitely behind it, the idea is to weaken the media that they consider as not favorable to their position or to their actions.
It is interesting, though, isn't it? It's a very, very new president, a very young president, and people had certain expectations of that sort of president. And he has called for dialogue with the media, expressing a willingness to compromise to safeguard press freedom in the country. Do people not accept that as a safeguard?
The new president, I think, made a statement during a government meeting yesterday. But at the same time, now the expectations are high. But to understand the context, we have to go back to the period before this president came to power, when we had a country which was completely divided into camps, where you have supporters of the president and of what was his former opposition, now in power, fighting really hard And during that period, it was interesting enough that those in power now were saying, okay, we would not accept anyone saying, okay, I'm a journalist, I want to be independent, this is a political fight, I stand for the truth. They wanted everybody to side by them. Some of the media were saying, well, that's not the role of the media. The role of the media is to try and be in between and to try and report independently, being at an equal distance between the two sides. That's something that this government did not accept at that time. And actually, it still continues on social media, the harassment. If you, people don't go back to that phase, to that period, it would be difficult to understand what's happening now. So these people are now saying, okay, now we're in power. All those who were saying, okay, we're neutral, we're independent, we are this, we are that, now you have to pay for it. And you can have a country where you have, I don't know, about publications are not regular, but between 40 and 45, I think we only had five media houses that did not take part to the boycott. The main media groups and broadcasters were part of this boycott. So it just tells you how deep is the divide.
So what was the message that the media houses were trying to convey?
I think their main message is they need to exist. They have the right to exist. I think at some point they called on the government. They said, okay, we are willing to pay our dues with the tax services, but we need to discuss ways to pay it. Let's find a way. But I think the government was very strict on saying, now people have to pay. I think some accounts were blocked by the fiscal services, tithing contracts between some media houses and public agencies or government agencies cut or suspended. I think the media owners are saying that's unfair. We should go back to business, and we need government to also help support that business.
I can't imagine living in a world, no media, no newspapers, no radio, no television, nothing. What was it like?
It was interesting. Of course, because of social media, you might think information was still circulating, news was circulating. Well, I mean, something very new. And also, all these media houses sending their cover pages where there was no news, but just saying, okay, a day without news, something like that, blackout day. Yeah, I mean, it was a sort of silly situation to live.
And do you think that the media are convinced that the president does want to have a conversation about this, you know, to resolve issues between them?
A bit early to say, because I think other statements just came out after the boycott. So probably we will have to be looking at what's going to happen in the days to come to be able to answer to that question with more authority.
I was going to ask you, actually, how much support do the media have in Senegal when they complain of harassment, when they complain of bullying, when they complain of this financial pressures being put on them in order to silence them? In fact, they're saying essentially that there's an attack on press freedom. Would Senegalese people recognize the relationship between government and the media as that? And not just this government, but, you know, the governments just passed.
Generally, the Senegalese citizens used to support the media. But now, since this government is new and have some popular base, remember they came to power with a 54% score, so their support base is still strong, and their support base is really very strong on social media. They came to power using social media a lot. You can tell that there are some people who would agree with government on this. But of course, more independent people, more independent thinkers, and people who understand the role in media in society are really a bit sorry about what's happening and trying to find a solution. And of course, you would have supportive voices supporting the media and their right to exist.
How would you describe the relationship between government and the media in the run-up to this particular blackout call?
Definitely, it has never been easy. But remember, this country has also a long tradition of free press, of independent journalism. I mean, it goes a long, long, long way back. Now, we had a particular situation between 2021 and 2023, when it was extremely difficult because of all the political tensions, and I think the journalists just became victims as everybody else. But in the past, we have had journalists who have been jailed, mostly. We have had journalists who have been fired from public service broadcasting and things like that. And it has happened. But compared to other countries, definitely it has been, or it was, much more easier to be a journalist in Senegal than in many other African countries.
Do you think that there might be future blackouts, future protests? In other words, will the situation deteriorate, or is there space for dialogue and accommodation?
Based on the latest statement, probably it looks like some avenues are being opened. People are making calls for the government to open negotiations. The president has instructed that the situation be addressed, that the crisis be addressed. Now, in what direction, it would be difficult to say. It is too early to know in what direction it will go.
Hamadou Tidiane C, an independent journalist in Dakar. Focus on Africa was put together by Rob Wilson, Bella Hassan and Nyasha Michelle. Connie Sharp was the senior journalist and Jonathan Greer was our technical producer. Our editors are Alice Mudengi and Andre Lombard. I'm Charles Gitonga. Thank you for your company and we'll talk again next time.